Continue our study of 2 Samuel. We'll be in chapters 5 and 6 this evening. And as we kind of, something we're going to do tonight as we go through 2 Samuel is there's those books over there called 1 and 2 Chronicles. You've heard of those? They parallel a lot of the same stories that we'll be looking at, the same history. They're written at a later time. And we'll kind of be going through the study and kind of showing where they mash up. So you have, you know, the Gospels and the four Gospel accounts, and you know they're written from different perspectives. They all harmonize in much the same way the Chronicles and the First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings. They harmonize to some degree. So we'll be looking at those. As well as we go through the study. You can go ahead and put up chapter 5 if you guys want to. I don't have the clicker tonight. There it is. All right, we've been working up to this point. So chapter 5, we finally get to a situation where the kingdom is united. What has hindered the unity so far for the kingdom of Israel? I'm sorry? There's been sort of a fight for the throne as to who would relinquish it. Who are some key players involved in that? Saul. Now, did Saul knew that his dynasty, according to God, had kind of come to an end, right? He wasn't going to, you know, according to God, he was not going to have a descendant on the throne in a ruling capacity. And did he kind of say, all right, that's good, we'll phase out and phase in, there'll be like a year overlap, and we'll make sure there's a smooth transition between the two dynasties. Is that the way he went with things? No, he did not. He fought it tooth and nail, and it was not smooth. And then even after his death, what took place that kind of hindered again unity after the death of Saul? Who stepped in? There's this power vacuum. Saul's no longer king. That weird name, his son, remember? Ishbosheth, yes, Ishbosheth, with the help of Abner, kind of comes in and takes the throne for a little while. But what happened to dear old Ishbosheth in chapter 4? He got killed till he died of it, right? You know, he was murdered in his sleep. Again, people who thought, well, we'll do David a favor and we'll go assassinate his enemy, and all will be well. And how did David respond to that? Not good, right? It wasn't good to do that. And David said that was not a good thing to do, to murder a man in his own house and asleep in his own bed. That's just not appropriate way of handling things. And so those gentlemen died. And so that's kind of where we left off last Wednesday. Chapter 5 opens up with this. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in, and the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you'll be ruler over Israel. So the people come to David at Hebron. Ishbosheth is dead. You have some options, right? You know, should we go to, it would probably be in the best interest of the nation, of the people, that they unified under David's banner. You could be, you know, the rogue tribe that decided not to. But it's best for Israel and for everybody involved, and to be obedient to God and God's will, we should come under the banner of David. They come to Hebron, right? And Hebron is where David had made his capital for the time being. What are they saying to David in these few verses? What are they saying to him in these first two verses especially? I'm sorry?
Take it.
Yeah, I mean, we're on your side now, right? Let's all play nice together. But the verbiage that's there, the words that are there, behold, your bone and your, we are your bone and your flesh. And we've heard that phrase probably a lot at a wedding, or a phrase very similar to it. But what are they saying? We are of the same, we're a kindred. We are family. And so they're coming together under that idea. And they're even saying that, you know, even when Saul was leading, you're the one who was really leading. Because, again, everybody loves David. But they specifically mention God having chosen David. And so it's not that it's just a kindred thing. It's not that, So you kind of have three things here. You have that we're related, you're doing a good job, and God said we needed to kind of, that you would be the shepherd. So those these three elements here in these first few verses as we open up here. And verse 3 says, so all the elders of Israel came out to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord, this agreement. And David was 30 years old when this took place. According to this verse, David was 30 years old when he became king. So that's our first little age marker for David. So that specifically gives us a time. And he became king, and he reigned for how long, according to this verse? 40 years. The first kings of, not counting Ishbosheth, that was just a tumultuous period. We'll sweep that one under the rug. But the first three main kings lasted 40 years each. And so that's an easy number for us to remember. And so David reigns for 40 years. Now we get to go to the transition period. Can we pull up the map, guys? I think on the... I can't remember which slide number it is. I'm sorry, I sprung that on you, Oz. I apologize. Yep, that's the way to do it. There it is. All right, so you see Hebron there, south of Jerusalem. Things are going to change now as we start talking about or going through the story of 2 Samuel. We're going to go to where the star is there in Jerusalem and going to make this change. So that's what we're going to be looking at tonight in chapter 5, these short verses here about that change. And so we can go back, just thumb through the next, sorry. I don't want you guys to fall asleep over there in the sound booth. You got to do something. All right. So the kingdom's united in the first few verses here. And now the king and his men go up to the Jebusites. Who are the Jebusites? Do we know? There's all these ites in the Bible, right? Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. There's all these groups of people. Who are these strange Jebusites? Look over in Genesis chapter 10. Somebody want to turn over to Genesis chapter 10, specifically verses 15 and 16, and give us a rundown on who these Jebusites are. Genesis chapter 10, verses 15 and 16. Who are these Jebusites? Related to whom? Heth. Who's related to? Huh? Who's related to? Go back up the chain. Who are these people coming from? What happened in Genesis early on? Flood, right? And we started over again, and you have what three sons? Shem, Ham, and Japheth, right? These Jebusites are descendants from the sons of Canaan, one of the sons of Canaan who was a son of Ham. And so they all go back to the boat, but don't we all? That's where they came from. So those Canaanites settled this area, and the Jebusites were in this land. Now, we're told in Numbers chapter 13, verse 29, that they dwelt in the mountains. What do we hear in geographically, what do we hear a lot in relationship to Jerusalem? You hear people talking about going up to Jerusalem. So we went up to Jerusalem. We went up. Even if they're in the north, what do we say in Florida? We're north and south, and I'm going to go up to Georgia, I'm going to go up, because that's north, basically, right? Unless you're going to Key West, you're pretty much going to go north in Florida, right? Going to go up there and visit family or whatever you're going to do. So in this relationship, geographically, Jerusalem was an elevated position. And so no matter where you were at Jerusalem, in Israel, if you're going to go to Jerusalem, you're going to go up to Jerusalem. You're going to go up. And so Numbers tells us that they dwelt in the mountains, which is where Jerusalem was. And they're also told in Joshua chapter 15 and Judges chapter 1 that they could not be driven out. They were not driven out, and they dwelt sort of kind of there with the Benjamites in that area. So David, now that the kingdom is united under his banner, he decides that Jerusalem is what they need. That's the next step. We're going to go to Jerusalem. And so the king and his men, verse 6, went up to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, and they said to David, "You shall not come up in here, but the blind and the lame will turn you away." So what's happening here? So David comes up in battle array, comes up to the Jebusite city in Jerusalem, and they say what, basically?
Trash talk.
It's some trash talk, right? This is some trash talk. This is nana nana boo boo. We've been here so long, nobody has ousted us. We've been here so long, nobody. We've dwelt in the middle of you guys, and you haven't been able to oust us from our perch, you silly kniggets. So in this situation, David comes up against him, and what happens as you read along? David is a man of war. What is going to happen? Do you think they're going to stay there very long? Probably not, right? Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold. We don't even get like a story like how it happened. We don't get any kind of information that we have. We have, if you were to, you know, make a movie of this scene, it would have been the cutaway scene when you went to commercial, and when you come back, David had the city. I mean, that's kind of what we get here. So they're making fun of him, thinking David cannot come in here. But verse 7, nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said on that day, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind. And so he kind of, you know, is trash-talking after having taken their city, which he can do. You know, he took that. Therefore, they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. So David lived in the stronghold and called the city it the city of David, and David built a wall around it, which part of that wall is still, you can still see part of the old wall of David in Jerusalem today, which is has been expounded upon later on throughout the history of Jerusalem. So there is the taking of Jerusalem, and then we have Hiram, king of Tyre. So if you have a new guy coming into power, what's a good thing to do? Maybe let's make some friends, right? Right. Who needs to make enemies? Incidentally, if you guys want to put out in your notes, chapter 5 of 2 Samuel coincides with 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 1 through 3 of chapter 5 coincide with verses 1 through 5 of chapter 5 coincide with the first three verses of 1 Chronicles chapter 11. And then we get the story of the Jebusites being taken over in verses 4 through 9 of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And then this story of the events of King Hiram we see in 1 Chronicles chapter 14. 1 Chronicles chapter 14, verses 1 through 7. So Hiram, he decides, let's make friends with David. Why be an enemy? He's pretty good at making war. And so he sends messengers to David with cedar trees and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a house for David. That's kind of nice, right? Somebody builds you a house. What do we hear over and over again whenever, like, Nehemiah goes to build a wall? And we hear this need for, I'm sorry?
They had a mind to work.
They had a mind to work, exactly. And the king gave them permission to cut down trees, the cedars. And so there's apparently in that area, the wood to build with is cedar. That's the wood to use for building anything. And so that's what happens here in relationship to David's household. Now, what does David realize in verse 12? What does he realize? That God is doing exactly what he said he would do, right? He is now becoming this king that God had promised him he would do. Have you ever had that realization? I mean, God gives us his message, right? He gives us His word he gives us and has said, I will be with you, I will never forsake you. There's those promises, the peace that passes understanding. And we read it, and we hear it, and we struggle through life, right? And we try to do the best we can. But every once in a while, and I hope that not on rare occasions, we are able to lift our head up and realize that God is doing exactly what he said he would do. And David here has this moment. David realized the Lord had established his kingdom over Israel. Now, it's hard, especially you look at David's life. He had a lot, kind of against him. What are some of his oppositions that David had? The struggle with Saul. I mean, that started early on, right? What were some other outside forces? The Philistines, those bad guys. Those are the guys in the black hats, right, in the story. Who else were in opposition to David? Any other opposition? Like maybe most of the majority of Israel, right? Because he came into power, they started kind of trickling over to him. So anyway, there was quite an opposition to him doing what he had to do. I don't know about you, but when there's opposition, do you just want to, hey, I want to fail today? Anybody do that? No? I want to do the hardest thing today on my list? No. If you make a list, where do you start? At the easiest thing. You might want to throw in some easy things in your list just to make sure. I brush my teeth. I marked that off my list today. I got that done. So, I mean, nobody starts at the hardest things. And so with David battling through all of that, going through those things, writing some psalms, you see his agony. And then here in this moment, he lifts up his head and said, God is doing exactly what he said he did or is going to do. That's huge. And that's something that we also need to realize in our lives. It's easy, and I think Satan would have us keep our nose to the grindstone and not look up. And keep our nose just kind of in whatever the world's throwing at us in the moment. But we need to look up and realize that we've come this far. God's been with us all this time, and it is not as bad as they say, that ominous they, right? So we need to realize, David realized it here, that God was doing exactly what he was going to do for him, making him king over Israel, and that he exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And so again, keeping things in perspective, who did David in this moment, who did David think it was for? Was it just for him? At the end of this verse, what does he say? Or what does he? For the sake of his people. So David is humble in realizing that it's not all about David. While he is exalting the kingdom of David, the kingship of David, it's not all about David, but for the sake of the people. That's what he had promised them. So God is fulfilling his promise to David and fulfilling his promise to the people. And that's a very good thing. Verse 13. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, we have this transition. Meanwhile, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem. There are some interesting laws in relationship to concubines. It's been stated that the word itself, concubine, wasn't the origin of the word is not even Hebrew. The origin may have been from some of the Canaanite tribes, but or groups of people. But he took some concubines, and we have some names that are of the children that are born to him in Jerusalem. So this is sort of a fast forward. Here's a list of some things that happened in Jerusalem for David. Among those names, do you see any that you recognize? Solomon. Now, we don't want to make sure that as we read this passage, that this is something that he had concubines in Jerusalem and he also had children in Jerusalem. It's not necessarily saying that these children are from concubines. I want to make sure we understand that as well. But those two things happened in Jerusalem. And that is also in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verses 5 through 8, lists these names as well, if you want to write that out there. 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verses 5 through 8. Now, we said those pesky Philistines, and here they decide to come in and make war again. Make war again. Verse 17. When the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to seek David out. Now, remember, David's like, you know, the arch enemy number one for the Philistines, right? He's killed so many of them. They have songs about it. And now he's king over Israel. And what do we read here? What are the Philistines? They hear that news, and what's their response? Let's go get him. Let's go kill him. Let's go kill David. Let's just do that. So they decide we're going to do that. And so David, all the Philistines went up to seek David out. David, and when David heard of it, he went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines came and spread themselves out in the valley of Rephaim. Then David inquired of the Lord. As David does these things, he inquires of the Lord. How important is that? We see where Israel failed in times past by not inquiring of the Lord. Hey, God, should we do this or not? Should we make a treaty with these people who said they're from, you know, a long ways away and are so sojourning here in this area? They didn't do it, and it cost them a lot. And so in this case, David, again, consults the Lord. And we see that whenever Saul was killed, what did he do? Should I go up to Israel? God said, yes. Where do I need to go to Israel? Go to Hebron. So, you know, he consults God along the way, which is very important. You know, that's an excellent, obvious life lesson for us, consulting God on our daily life. Big life changes, let's talk to God about that. Let's see what maybe we need to pray to God about what we need to be doing in our lives. So in this situation, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And the Lord said to David, go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand. So David came, and I like how that is. Are you going to give them into my hand? Yes, I will give them. I will certainly give them into your hand, for sure. I like how that's worded there. And the Lord said to go up. And so David, in verse 20, David came to Baal Perazim and defeated them there. And he said, the Lord has broken through my enemies before me like the breakthrough of waters. Therefore, he named the place Baal Perazim. And so what is the imagery that we have as far as David's army breaking through the line of the Philistines? What imagery that we especially could relate to in Florida with the beach? Waves crashing through, right? Did y'all have caffeine this evening firing? Okay, so waves crashing through, right? And how destructive is water? We know how destructive water is, right? Even just a few drops of water can be destructive and costly. And so in this case, they were waves that came up against the Philistines. And what did they do? They abandoned, so they came up against them like waters, and therefore they named that place. And verse 21 says, they abandoned their idols, so David and his men carried them away. They abandoned their idols. So, you know, they brought their idols out with them because that's, you know, that helps them. In this case, it did not. And David and his men carried them away. If you leave it just like that, it's like, well, why would you do that, David? You know, maybe to melt them down. They were costly. Maybe, you know, what? Look over in 1 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 12. 1 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 12. What does it say in 1 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 12 that they did with these statues? So they carried them away and did what with them? Burned them. So they didn't burn them on the battlefield. They took them to a better place to burn them, and they burned them. So that gives us a more complete image of what happened with those idols. Verse 22, now the Philistines came up once again. Now, fool me once, right? So the Philistines come up against David again. It wasn't bad enough that they lost that time. The Philistines come up against David again. And spread themselves out in the valley in the same area. And when David inquired of the Lord, which he was accustomed to do, what is God saying this time? As you look at the text, in these next few verses, beginning of verse 23, what does God tell him to do? That's go in. So you know, in the last battle, They had come against them like water rushing through the rocks, right? They had routed them before head on. God says, this time, go around behind. Now, as you read this, you should not go directly up. Circle around behind them. Come at them from the balsam trees. It shall be when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then you shall act promptly. For then the Lord will have gone out before you to strike the army of the Philistines. And so what's happening, the balsam trees are a species what do they call it? Of aspen. Has anybody seen aspen trees? What's that? Mulberry? Okay. They say it's, depending on which historian you talk to, apparently. But it is, it does, well, with the aspen, if you've ever seen an aspen or an aspen tree or heard wind blowing through trees, does it make a noise when you hear the wind blowing through trees? Can it be creepy when you hear the wind blowing through trees? In this case, he's saying when you hear the sound of marching troops through the balsam trees. And so what's happening is this sound coming through the tops of the trees amplifies what the Philistines think is coming upon them. So here in this situation, they're out there to go after David. And then all of a sudden you hear these troops coming down the hill, coming down the valley from behind you. Is that a good position to be in? So here you are, you're thinking everything's going to come out, happen in front of you. Anybody ever been prepared for a frontal attack and all of a sudden it comes from behind you? That's not good. That's exactly why, you know, in military today, they pay a high dollar to have information about movement of troops. In this situation, with that sound coming through the trees, they thought there were a lot of troops coming down on top of them, and then David's men came in and cleaned them up. And they did. Then David did so, just as the Lord had commanded them, and struck down the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. So he talks about how far they chased them and cutting them down. So again, asking God, should we do this thing? Yes. How should we do this thing? Do it this way. We will do this thing that way. That sort of formula works. Are we seeing that in David's life? Ask God, what should I do? God tells me what I should do. I do what God tells me I should do. And as we see David's life, is his life blessed because he operated based on that formula? Yes. I mean, it's not saying that it was always roses, right? I mean, he had some opposition. He had problems, but God was with him. And we'll see later on when you deviate from that system, when you deviate from that formula, that things can go bad for you. And so we'll see that later on in this book. Chapter 6, Ark of the Covenant is brought to Jerusalem. This coincides a lot with 1 Corinthians chapter 13, these first two verses. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 6. Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. All right, now what do we know about the Ark? Where has it been? It was basically at somebody's house. You know, Saul, they tried to move it. They got it away from the Philistines, and they basically parked it. There was some Levites who were in charge of taking care of it, and they took care of it in that place. And now David's wanting to bring it up to Judah, or up to, to Jerusalem, and they decide that that's what they need to do. Now, what do we know about the Ark specifically? What does it look like? What does the Ark look like?
A box.
It is a box. If you read the name Ark in the Old Testament, you are reading about a box. And so Numbers chapter 4 talks about the box, verses 2 through 15, and that the descendants of Kohath were to carry it, the specific, not just any Levite could carry it, but descendants of Kohath, this specific Levite family where, or lineage, were to carry this ark. And we are told that they were, this thing was made from shittim wood, and it was covered in gold, and that the rods that were through the rings were to, you know, supposed to be carried in that fashion. And what do we see as far as how the ark looks? What does it look like? Do you remember? Exodus chapter 31, verses 1 through 11, talks about what the ark looks like. How would you describe the ark? Has the two cherubim. Anybody seen, you know, Indiana Jones at all? That's actually a pretty close description. I haven't measured the Indiana Jones version, if it's the right cubit height and width. But that's a pretty accurate description. So it was basically a box with rings with two long stabs through it that were all covered in gold. It had a kind of an edge around it with two cherubim, two angels on it with their wings overstretched towards each other in the box. Yes, it was all gold. This thing was just gold. It was all gold, and it was actually made from hammered gold. It wasn't something that it was. It wasn't smelted and poured into form. It was hammered into form. This is according to the Old Testament text, and so it says this here about the ark. The very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. Why is that significant? Enthroned above the cherubim. Do you know what another name for that space, that thing above where the angels were? Do you remember the other name? The mercy seat. The mercy seat. Look over in Exodus chapter 25. Exodus chapter 25, verses, specifically verses 17 through 22. It says, "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long." He talks about the place. He talks about the cherubim in verse 19. And talks about how it's positioned. And it talks about their wings being spread out. Verse 22, "You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony which I will give you." Verse 22, "There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in the commandment for the sons of Israel." So this mercy seat is rather important. This is where God came to speak to his people. So this is a extremely important object. It is extremely holy and to be revered and to be treated as such. We saw what happened to the Philistines when they did not treat it that way. And, we wouldn't wish that on anybody. And so Exodus chapter 25, verses 17 through 22 give us that information about the ark. Also, Exodus 37, 6 through 9, very similar information. But that is where God is saying, "I will speak to you, Moses, from the mercy seat." Something else that's interesting, Exodus chapter 31, verses 1 through 11, tells us that the tribe or people from the tribe of Judah made this ark. People from the tribe of Judah made this ark. Why is that significant to David? He's from the tribe of Judah. So why is David? I mean, not only is it an extremely important artifact to the nation of Israel, but possibly it's important to David as his family. That's kind of their. I don't want to say it's this. This is just reading between the lines, but. But it's important that it was their family that made the ark. And so I find that interesting in relationship to how David reveres the ark and takes care of it in such a way. Now, what did they do wrong right off the bat in verse 3? So we know, we've read how they're supposed to transport the ark. What did they do wrong?
Put it on a cart.
Which makes sense, right? I mean, if you're going to move something that is this big and covered with that much gold, it's probably not light. It would make sense to put it on an ark. But is that what God asked? No, yes. And it appears they may have gotten lazy. It seemed right. It seemed like the right thing to do. How many times have you started a something and said, well, it seemed at the time the right thing to do? And in this situation, that's what we see here. They put it on, at least it was a new cart. They might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. Now, Ahio was in front and Uzzah was in back. And they came to a threshing floor, which basically just means it was the spot in the road that they came to. It, not necessarily that they were going over the threshing floor. That wouldn't make sense for them to do that necessarily, because a threshing floor would be off the beaten path. Threshing floor. How many of you have threshing floors in your house? It's usually a stone or circle-like place where they would beat out the grains and then throw it up in the air and the wind blow the chaff away. So that's not a highway, right? So this gives us a landmark as to where this was happening, possibly. So meanwhile, David and the house of Israel were celebrating. How are they celebrating this event? According to the text, how are they celebrating this event? With all kinds of instruments made of fir wood, with lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And so they're celebrating this in this fashion. And instrumental music is mentioned here. So next Sunday, I expect some of you to have some fir wood instruments and harps and stuff, right? No, that doesn't give us authority to do anything as much as it gives us authority to have an ark or to make sacrifices with lambs or anything. So anyway, moving on, they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, and Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it. Yeah, I mean, that was not a good thing. I mean, they're already not doing the right thing by the way they're transporting it, right? They're already not doing it the right way. And Uzzah reaches out and touches it, and he dies. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and that God struck him down there for his... Why was he struck down? Because he cared so much about the ark, and he touched it. He was irreverent to something that was so holy. What were some other people who were struck down because of using strange fire who were irreverent? Nadab and Abihu were irreverent, and they were using strange fire. Not that it was fire that was burning blue and not yellow. It was fire that was from a place that God had not said. And so they were irreverent with what God had given them. And so at this point, Uzzah is struck down. What is David's response? Verse 8. He was angry. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place was called Perez Uzzah to this day. So David was afraid of the Lord that day. Do you think they stopped? Somebody touched the ark? They probably stopped. Right? So if you want, just incidentally, I apologize, 1 Corinthians 13, 7 through 14, kind of detail this as well. 1 Corinthians 13, 7 through 14 goes through this same section of Scripture. And so they stop. How can the ark of the Lord come to me, is what David said. And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him, but David took it aside the house of... Okay, yeah. It killed a guy. I was the one in charge of moving it. I'm not taking it to my house. Where is he putting it? Somebody else's house, right? Sure, back on out in here. Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it. Children go to aunt's house, right? So they put it in this guy's house. Thus the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Ed and all his household. So that time that was in his household, he was blessed. He may have heard the story of what happened to the Philistines and thought, well, this might not go so well, but in this situation, he was blessed. Just incidentally, if you want to keep this some timeline information here, you want to turn to 1 Corinthians 15, 1 through 24, in between verses 11 and 12, 1 Corinthians 15, 1 through 24 kind of take place. We will not cover that, but just for you to read on your own. And then beginning of verse 12, we have 1 Corinthians 15, 25 through 16, 3. 1 Chronicles. Am I saying Corinthians?
Yeah.
1 Chronicles. Because abbreviated, like it's like CH. Sorry, anyway. 1 Chronicles 15, 1 through 24 happen in between 11 and 12. And 1 Chronicles 15, verse 25 through chapter 16, verse 3, kind of finish out this chapter 6 for us. So what happens when David finds out that he's being blessed in verse 12? So this guy's being blessed because the ark is there. Now I want it in my house, right? That makes sense. So David said, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on account of the ark. And so David went out and brought the ark of God to the house and brought it up with gladness, I'm sure. In verse 13, and so it was when the bearers of the ark of the Lord had gone six places, they sacrificed an ox and the fatling. And you see this progression and of all they're bringing up the ark, and you see this the trumpet, the sounds, this joyous event. And it happened as the ark of the Lord came to the city of David that Michal, the daughter of Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she just loved him even more. What does it say happened? She despised him. I think what the street term would be, he was acting the fool in her eyes. And so she did not like him for that. So they brought forth the ark and set it in its place in the tent which David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and the peace offerings for the Lord. And David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings. He blessed all the people and he distributed food. And we see that and talks about the food that they distributed. Verse 20, when David returned to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself today in the eyes of the servants and the maids and the foolish and shamelessly uncovers himself." It is not, it talks about how he was dressed. He was wearing linen. He was wearing the ephod. It was not that he was naked. He was not dressed like a king. He was not dressed in the way that she thought that he needed to be dressed, was not dressed in a way that demanded respect and authority that she thought he needed to be demanded. And what is David's response to this? I'm sorry? It was before the Lord. I wasn't doing this for you and your fashion sense. This was for the Lord, right? And it was because the Lord who chose me above your father, twist of dagger, and above all his house, twist the dagger, and appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. And so we see that David responds correctly and responds in a way that he said, basically, he said, I will be esteemed because of what I have done. In verse 23, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. So she didn't get to have any kids because of that. Any questions, comments, or anything? All right, we will have a guest speaker in. I'll be gone next Wednesday, and we'll continue the study of 2 Samuel. Thank you very much.